Twofootedtackle.com.
Yes, it's Two-Footed Tackle pod time, and we're already taking our tentative steps on the road to Euro 2012. England learn how to score again, no matter how ugly the players are, as Capello's men top their group after two games, while Scotland came close to surpassing that result against the Faroe Islands. Meanwhile, it's by Boyo as Toss steps down from the Wales job, the one position Phil Brown hasn't yet linked himself with. Plus, there's MLS, Premier League, and a look back at the weekend that was non-league day. All that and more on the Two-Footed Tackle podcast. Hello. Yes, this is indeed the Two for the Tackle podcast with me, Gary Andrews. On the pod this week, as ever, the internetless still, Chris Nee. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
How are you doing, other than the lack of internet?
The internet's coming on Monday.
Hooray. We can now ditch that running joke.
We can, and probably get a bit more detail on MLS as well.
Quite possibly. And, well, we'll be all the best for it. This week's guest is PickLive's CEO and Two for the Tackle pod regular, Tim Morgan. Tim, hi. I actually have on my notes that Chris wrote for me, Tim and the Wand written down. I've absolutely no idea what this means. Chris didn't tell me. So any elaboration or any ideas why that's on there?
Well, I'm Tim, and the Wand is my right foot, which is... I'll get up for you, actually. So that is okay. The Wand. Called the Wand because of the magic it's able to create on a football pitch. Some people say... Well, it's actually a separate legal entity, and so some people say that today, for example, you have got Tim Morgan on the pod, not the Wand. If you want to get the Wand, then you're probably going to have to speak to her agent.
It's a her. It's female.
It is female, yeah.
I'm surprised you've revealed all this, actually. I was expecting a slightly reluctant kind of agreement to just mention it and then move on.
I'm very proud of my association with the Wand. Touch the Wand if you want, Chris.
I've touched the Wand before, but I'm not going to do it on live radio.
But yeah, it's so cultured. Sometimes I wake up in the morning, I'm a bit drowsy, and I look to the end of the bed and the Wand is reading The Tragedy of Man by Imre Malak, the Hungarian poet. Both in Hungarian and in translation, of course.
I'm very glad the Wand is that part of the anatomy on the bottom half of your body and nothing else on it.
The common misconception.
Well, indeed.
No doubt.
Indeed. Both weave magic in different ways.
Very true.
Okay, well, let's get down to the very messy business. England internationals. Columnists calling for Capello's head, scandal surrounding Wayne Rooney, that's all before a ball had even been kicked. Yes, England racked up convincing scorelines, you have to say, against Bulgaria. Chris, and probably more impressively of the two, away at Switzerland.
Yeah, very good result away in Switzerland, actually. I was kind of expecting a minimum of 4 points from these games, and I was expecting the one to come from that away tie. Switzerland, of course, notoriously difficult to break down. But if you go there and get an early goal, then anything can happen, and 3-1, I thought, was a fairly predictable result.
Predictable?
Mm.
Wow, okay. I mean, that's...
Only because I had a bet on it.
Well, to Chris's betting come back in again. Terrible stuff. Yeah, so, on there, let's go for Bulgaria first. They were poor.
I think England probably made them look poor in parts as well, because I think the England performance was solid enough to deserve 3 or 4 nil. Obviously, fantastic goal-scoring performance from Jermaine Defoe. I thought Wayne Rooney had a decent game as well. And then Adam Johnston getting on the score sheet in both games is a fantastic development for us, isn't it? And it's really exciting to see him coming through in this cycle ahead of the Euros.
And for the Switzerland game, I mean, it's a convincing scoreline when you look at 3-1, but at 1-0, England did have the jitters, didn't they? Because, Switzerland pushing forward, Joe Hart suddenly sort of had a brief case of the shakes. England were under Lacoste, then Switzerland got a man sent off. Adam Johnston gets that second goal, and from then on it looked like, well, Switzerland pulled one back with a fantastic stride.
Yeah, it certainly helps to get men sent off just as you are getting a little bit jittery at the back. But business is business, and they managed to overcome that. Got a bit of a helping hand from that decision. And then came through and... Probably were pretty comfortable in the last sort of few minutes. There was no exciting finish or anything. So I think a solid 6 points, another great start to qualifying, and reason to be cheerful.
Tim, no Lampard in this because of injury. Given how well England actually seem to work together, do you think that could actually be it on his international career?
I think it could be. I think it would take a brave coach to sort of enforce that. I think us guys actually spoke on one of the sort of pre-World Cup podcasts about it, and in my eyes, anyway, there were two sort of real problems. The first was there was a sort of a sense that lots of the players didn't like each other. A lot of people who've been around for a long time. And I think blood in some of the new players like Adam Johnson, Joe Hart, has really helped that, sort of reinvigorated the whole setup there. The other thing is, specifically regarding Lampard, is I think Lampard, Gerrard and Barry are far too similar to accommodate all three of them in the middle of the pitch. And so it doesn't matter how good they are at club level. What you need are players who know what their jobs are, and their jobs are distinct enough for them to be able to do them well. And so I don't think it's a coincidence. I think Frank Lampard's a very good footballer. I just think that he perhaps, if you have a Gerrard, is superfluous. And so, you know, England have been great. It's good to see them playing that way again, and have really blown the whole group open, actually.
And in terms of the back as well, John Terry was missing, as was Rio Ferdinand. Yeah. And you have to say that all four defenders who appeared, because obviously Dawson was injured, Case O'Cahill came on, and then Lescott partnering Jagielka in the second game, Jagielka playing both games. You've got to say they acquitted themselves fairly well.
They certainly did. And again, there was a real sort of freshness to them. There's a real sense of excitement about them, and England look different as a result. Plus, you know, I've said for a long time, you don't have to be that good to qualify out of a group like this. You don't have to be playing in the Champions League, for example. You absolutely don't. You just need to want to be able to play and to be at a level that all of those players are, as is Matthew Upson, as is Roger Johnson. You know, England have got a lot of centre halves who could get England out of that group, and it's about picking the ones who want to be there, who get on best with the others, in order to deliver the results.
And I guess getting international experience as well, because if you start playing the qualifiers, then when it comes to the tournament, assuming you qualify, you can't say, well, this player's too green to throw them in.
Absolutely right. And it's a shame, maybe, that it didn't happen like during the World Cup. But I think we just have to put that behind us now and say, well, it's happened now. You know, long may it continue.
Absolutely. Chris, obviously, Capello has announced that he's going to be stepping down. Now, it's curious to me, because it always seems with Capello, or certainly since the World Cup, if England do well, it's the players. If England lose, it's Capello. He really can't win. And I'm sure there's probably a few champagne corks popping in Fleet Street because of the Capello news, not least Sean Custis on The Sun.
Sean Custis, he's following Socrates' meetup on Twitter.
Is he?
Yeah.
Is he going to come along?
I don't know. Okay. Possibly. It'd be an interesting one if he did, wouldn't it?
Very.
Yeah, the timing's very odd, isn't it? Because I initially sort of met the news with a bit of a shrug. I thought it's not like he's going now. It's coming to the end of a cycle. He'll have had two major tournaments behind him. I wouldn't be a surprise to see him go at that point regardless, but to announce it now is very strange, because you just think there's going to be the cacophony of new stuff that's going to be coming through in the last sort of 3 months before that competition, assuming we qualify for it.
But
it's going to be huge, because all of these media friendly managers, I know who I'm talking about, are going to be bigging themselves up for months before that job becomes available. It's totally going to be disruptive.
But on the other hand, you can two things you could perhaps argue that. The first is that Bobby Robson, we knew he was stepping down before the World Cup in 1990, mm-hmm. and he had a lot of vitriol put on. England's best performance since 1966 in a major tournament then. The second one, I know this is something Simon Cooper's talked about before, that football doesn't necessarily go about recruiting in the way that any other major business would, because it normally, if you're identifying a new CEO or something, you take several months over it, whereas football seems a very rushed appointment. This, they've got 2 years to try and work with and identify the successor, so it might be that they can start working and start looking at that and assessing the options. So by the time you get to at the end of 2012, the end of the tournament, you will have a good option. You'll have people in place ready to move in there, assuming I'm crediting the FA with any modicum of sense there.
Well, to address those two points, the first one, yes, it certainly doesn't spell disaster in 2012 by any stretch of the imagination. We could go there and do very well, even knowing that Capello's going. The amount of time that we have to appoint a replacement, I don't think you can do that in football with more than about 6 months to go, unless they're planning on bringing somebody in who's going to be younger, maybe less experienced than we used to in the England setup. So somebody that they're going to have to
Ian Holloway
start preparing maybe a couple of years in advance. I think it's going to be a really interesting appointment on that basis, because it suggests to me that they're not looking at the Martin O'Neills and the Harry Redknapps of this world, and they're in fact looking at somebody who's going to come in a bit younger on, maybe David Beckham.
What do you make of Capello and everything gone there, Tim?
I do think it's not the end of the world for 2012. I think there is a chance as well that it could galvanise the players. You sometimes see at major tournaments one last hurrah ship. It only works if the players like the manager. So, you know, they're doing it for him because they realise it's his last sort of job. And I don't know whether Capello has that with the England players. So I don't think it's the end of the world. I take Chris's point. It's very interesting about whether there is somebody lined up. And so, you know, they've had a very frank conversation over at the FA where they've said, you know, look, Fabio, we've known for a while you're not going to stay around. You know, if you announce it now, then we'll be able to do something where, you know, we'll put someone together with you. And, yeah, it could be Ian Holloway, could be David Beckham, could be Kenny Sansom.
Let's just briefly look elsewhere in the group. We will come to Wales because we've got a big chat on that, so we'll just put them to one side. But, Chris, Montenegro... a lot of people thought Switzerland would be the team in there. Montenegro have suddenly given themselves a real shout. I guess for people who sort of look at it, it's a former Yugoslavian team, so made up of some of those players there, or have that tradition of Yugoslavian teams in there. So, you know, they're always going to be very dangerous, especially with Vukinic in there as
well. Yeah, so I'll be completely honest, he's pretty much the only player that I can name off the top of my head from that team. So it's perhaps a little surprising to see them get off to such a good start. Not so surprising to see him be such a pivotal character in that. I think Switzerland are going to be the team for England to beat over the course of the group. And obviously having the slight advantage over them now, I think we'll manage it without too much difficulty.
Elsewhere, if we're talking about minnows, Tim, Liechtenstein, probably about 2 seconds away from their greatest ever result, you have to say. And, I mean, Scotland now are in the very unusual position of topping that table in Group I ahead on goal difference ahead of Lithuania, yet they have probably played some of the worst football of any of the home nations.
Yeah, they have, and I like Scotland, but in that instance, Liechtenstein were so close. You know, I was kind of hoping that perhaps they could hold out at least for a point. There isn't really any excuse for it. You know, Wales losing to Montenegro, we'll probably get onto it, isn't good. You know, occasionally you lose to sides, Bulgaria, Switzerland, Romania, you go into some of the, you know, the Slavic countries, even some of the Baltic countries. But a side like Liechtenstein, as I understand it, it's 150,000 population, it's really a city. Most of them are tax exiles, they're not even from there, they sort of qualify for it. It would be like drawing or losing to a very small town. You know, I'm certain that most league sides would beat Liechtenstein, if not all of them. And so you should sweep them away. Everybody should be able to. And it is not a good sign for Scottish football that they run them so close.
And Chris, Seb Geffers, a new columnist on Two Footed Tackle from Inside Left, who some of you may have read. He made roughly the same point on the blog earlier
Absolutely,
today.
Yeah. Post entitled Top of the Table. But it's probably the only table topping win that's going to require a post mortem quite as harsh as Seb's. But he's got a very good point. It's not good that they came so close to only getting a point from that game, and it does point to slightly deeper problems within Scottish football that are far more problematic than the ones that we bang on about with England here.
But you know, good news for another of the home nations, Northern Ireland, regulation 1-0. But Slovenia, you have to say, I mean, Slovenia are a good side. They were at the World Cup. That's a very good result for the Northern Irish.
It is a fantastic result in a very, very tough group. And to have any hope at all of qualifying for the Euros, then they are going to need to beat those four teams and then nick a goal or two when it comes to the likes of Serbia.
Northern Ireland have a sense of unity that all of the home nations could learn masses from. They are a proper team.
They have been for years as well. I mean, they had that horrible run where they couldn't score a goal, but ever since then, it's been team spirit that's carried them to a lot of pretty famous wins.
Totally, and from a smaller and smaller sort of talent pool to choose from.
Absolutely. Their neighbours in the Republic, though, have got off to an absolute flyer, 2 wins out of 2. And with Russia losing to Slovakia as well, you've got to say that's now thrown the group wide open, Tim. And I thought when the draw came out, I thought, you know what? The Irish might just fancy themselves for this one, especially with the sense of injustice going before. They'll be really fired up for it. You look at it now and you go, okay, Slovakia, good team. Russia, very good team. Macedonia and Armenia are always going to cause sort of the odd hiccup. But hell, you know, we could be seeing them at the Euros.
I don't think we will, Gary. Okay. And obviously they, you know, they've had a good start. That group is not strong, and with Russia struggling, it's easier than it kind of should be. But I imagine that Slovakia and Russia will go through from that group. I think this is the worst Irish side we've had for quite a long time. If you look at their first 11, there are a lot of players that are fall into the category, I think, of journeyman professionals rather than highly talented footballers. So I think that the wheels will fall off the wagon on that one in time. I say it slightly with some reticence because I'd love them to go through. They haven't qualified for a tournament for a little while now, and they're always great. They have great travelling support. But I don't think that they have that strong of a group of players to choose from over the course of, 10 games.
Do you think as well, because you probably haven't read Seb's post, but he mentioned on there that now where Scotland used to be able to call on the likes of Gemmell and whoever, they're now calling on championship players or players who play in a weakened Scottish league. And then you look at the Irish teams as well and the Welsh team as well, and you think, well, again, they're calling on championship players. And I know everybody goes on about, well, you know, all the foreigners hurting English players. It seems to actually be hurting the other home nations more than English players.
Well, I think there's a difference, actually. I think it's hurt Ireland and Scotland far more than it's hurt Wales. And we can get onto Wales separately. But in terms of Ireland and Scotland, I think that is absolutely true. And the way that you see it is what the Premiership has got. I think the Championship now is as good as the Premiership was in the late 80s in terms of the quality of players. I support Swansea, as you know. Every week when I watch them, there are internationals on show. That would never have been the case 15 or 20 years ago. We have internationals in our side, not just Welsh internationals. So there's that. The way it's really shown as well is that when Scottish players come down to play in the Championship, players who played at Rangers and Celtic, they don't look like superstars. They don't dominate games. James McFadden, when he was playing for Birmingham in the Championship, looked like a very ordinary footballer. He looked like a championship level footballer. The other thing that happens the other way around is that Joe Ledley is, to date, a championship player, and he's quite comfortable playing for Glasgow Celtic at that sort of level. So I think the Scottish League is has more in common with the Championship than it does with the Premiership, and there are less Scottish and Irish players playing in the Premiership. So yes, I think the Premiership has been particularly bad for those two countries. But don't forget, Ireland historically didn't have that strong of a side. They did very well for a period, which was when they had very dubious rules as to what qualified somebody as being Irish.
Townsend, Cascarino.
Correct. And a lot of people in the world qualify via those sort of tenuous connections. Since that's changed, I don't think it's a coincidence that that they haven't been as good as they used to be.
Chris, let's just turn our attention to some of the other teams. And if we, you know, teams in crisis, you don't really get much more than Portugal, do you? I mean,
no.
One point, they're Norway topping the table with 6, and that's it's a smaller group as well, so every point counts in that group. Letting, 4-4 draw with Cyprus.
It's incredible, isn't it? Cyprus get involved in some right old goal fest, don't they?
Cyprus are an interesting team. I mean, they've really been picking themselves up over the recent years. But I mean, Portugal have got Quiroz as well, mm-hmm. who's banned for disrupting a doping test. And it's a tough group as well. Norway, Denmark, Cyprus, Iceland, all of those teams are not easy.
No, they're not. And Norway and Denmark in particular are going to be a formidable duo to get past after such an awful start. I think Portugal are probably done for already in this group.
Mm. And no Ronaldo as well in that. I mean, it'd be quite good to see the Scandinavian teams back into the Euros. Cause I always really enjoy watching them. I think they're very entertaining.
Well, Denmark did their bit in the World Cup, didn't they? And Norway have been involved in some interesting matches over the years. So it would be good to see them back in there. Sweden as well, topping their group.
Mm, absolutely. Just look round elsewhere. I mean, Group D is an interesting one as well, Tim, because you've got France there who had that, lost to Belarus and then went and on home soil, then went to beat Bosnia away, which is a tough trip on there. in a kind of very oddly poised group, with Albania and Belarus topping the group 4 points each. Then Bosnia ahead of France on goal difference. Romania in there as well. I think you can obviously discount Luxembourg. But, yeah, again, French, another big name, who already, because of a poor-ish start, although Bosnia is a great result, looking slightly vulnerable for qualifying.
Yeah, they're in a bit of a transition phase, though. And what I've been most impressed with, and what I think will work, they're another example of a team that doesn't. They don't have to be that good to get out of that group. With the players that they've got, they could probably pick their second 11 and get out of that group. And that is what they need to do. And I don't know if you saw the goals against Bosnia, but France against Bosnia looked like a side with unity. There was a big celebration, I don't know if you saw it, involving people who weren't on the pitch at the time. I think that's always a good side. I don't mean fans. I mean the manager and the other staff. I think there's unity. I think they've got a bunch of people who want to play for France again. And, you know, they don't need their superstar names to beat the likes of Belarus and Bosnia. So I think they should stick with the side. A lot of them are quite young, and there's not that many caps between them. And I think that they will come through that group quite comfortably, just because the quality of that group is not that high. If they start feeling like they need to rely on some of the older players and get involved in any of the politics again, then they might well be in a lot of trouble.
They've upheld Evra's ban today, I think.
They have indeed, yes. Yes, indeed.
Good move.
Talking about another team who crashed out at the World Cup, Italy as well, Chris. They very, very nearly came a cropper against Estonia. Very, very late goals to take them to a win against Estonia, then regulation win over the Faroes. Mm-hmm. I mean, they sit atop their group, but same as they kind of were at the World Cup, I think you have to say. Not particularly convincing as a side.
Not convincing, but thankfully in those two games... Sorry, I'm going to be all pro-Italian. thankfully, those two games got the job done, and that at this stage is what's important as Prandelli starts to try and mould the team in his own image. Started off very badly for him with a defeat against the Ivory Coast in a friendly. Two wins out of two is as much as you can ask of that team at the moment, because there are going to be changes. There is going to be a change in style, probably formation. There will be tactical differences, and there will be personnel changes. And I am delighted to see Cassano on the score sheet for them again.
Absolutely, and he seems to have found a slight sense of maturity as well, which is not a word you'd necessarily associate with Cassano.
Well, it's in some of the stuff that he says, as well as the way he plays and the way he behaves on the pitch now as well. So I think there's a sort of back end of his career serenity about him at the moment, and if he can turn that into relaxed, entertaining football, then all the better for the rest of us.
Chris, also one last question before we move properly on to the thing that everybody's been waiting to listen to, the Welsh manager situation. Has there been a less European group than Group F?
It's pretty impressive, isn't it?
Consisting of Croatia, Israel, Latvia, Georgia, Greece and Malta.
But I don't think there has, really. It'd be difficult to think that it would be, because, I mean, obviously having Latvia and Georgia in there as well as Israel is going to tip the balance, and then having Croatia and Malta as well. It's pretty impressive stuff.
It's an interesting group, actually, because you'd probably say it's one where you could see, well, Croatia will obviously be favourites for that one, but you could see anyone in the other team.
Anyone who steps up, because Greece would be the sort of traditional second team in there, but they're not necessarily going to be good enough, so... It's going to be interesting if maybe Israel, Latvia can step up. We might see a proper new face in there.
Absolutely. Okay, right. Well, let's get on to the Welsh result. Now, it's taken a while, but John Toshek has finally gone after that 1-0 loss against Montenegro. And let's start with that game, which is kind of where it's all, you would say, unravelled, but it almost felt like typical Wales, which... Mm. You know, a few years ago, Wales would be expected to, if not, you know, defeat Montenegro, at least hold them to a draw on their own patch. Yet this just felt like you could see a sense of inevitability, I guess, coming on them.
Yeah, they've looked like that for a while, actually, and they've looked like it throughout sort of Toshak's tenure. He said, judge me on my World Cup 2010 qualifying results, where he finished fourth out of a group of six. It's amazing that they didn't then judge him when he's told them to.
And you look at the their ranking as well, and they've dropped nearly 20 places, I think,
Wales. It is incredibly low, and for the talent in the side, it's desperate. And you're absolutely right. You know, I get very excited and I watch Wales in these games, and I always believe, because of the talent that we've got, that we can beat pretty much anyone. I think we can beat Switzerland. I think we can beat Bulgaria. Maybe, you know, maybe this is my heart talking, but I sincerely think that we should be able to beat those sides at least once. We should be able to beat them at home. And then you watch them against Montenegro, and I have seen a performance like that 15 or 20 times over the last 5 or 6 years, ever since Mark Hughes ended up being the Wales manager, and it is simply not good enough. And it's not just the defeat, it's the nature of the defeat, it's the fact that, you know, the referee is blamed and these silly things like that. Ultimately, our best players didn't perform to the top of their ability. Tactically, I don't think we were quite right. We weren't particularly motivated. The best two players on the pitch were David Vaughan and Ashley Williams, who are not the two of the superstars within the side. And what Wales need is somebody who is able to get the best out of their best players. And John Toshak is not that man, has never been that man. He might have been that man in 1982 when he took the Swans from Division 4 to Division 1 in consecutive seasons, but he was 36 years old at the time. He was brand new to it. He had a lot, you know, he'd played at Liverpool, he had the respect of the players. He was seen as, you know, fairly modern manager, and he's not that guy. And it's demonstrated by the way that some of the older players have responded to him. I've never seen so many retirements over the course of a manager's tenure, while the player continues to play in the Premier League, in the case of Simon Davis or Ryan Giggs, or I think even maybe Robbie Savage at the time that he left. The players don't want to play for John Toshak. They don't want to travel to Belarus on a Wednesday night to play for John Toshak, and they need to find somebody who they do want to play for. Mm. And they need to do it soon. There are other sort of things in play, I suppose, that mean it's not easy.
Well, I mean, I guess when Toshak first took over as well, because Hughes, I think, you know, he'd done a fantastic job with the Euro, nearly getting to Euro 2004. Then you could see the Welsh sort of talent base slowly crumbling there. Hughes left. And there wasn't really anybody who you naturally think would be a natural successor to Hughes at that point in time. And if you were just looking solely at Welsh candidates, I think the other one at the time was Brian Flynn. And Toshak, I guess, to me kind of seemed like the obvious one, even if he had been sniping from the sidelines as a pundit quite a bit. You kind of went, well, who else is there at that point in time?
Well, I don't agree in that. Well, first, I have absolutely no idea why the manager of Wales needs to be Welsh. One of my colleagues who was an Arsenal fan told me it's because, like, it couldn't be an Englishman, for example. And you might think that, but, you know, most football supporters in Wales support either Swansea or Cardiff. They're used to English managers. What they want is success. Nobody cares where they come from. They're used to managers from outside of the UK. Why does the Welsh manager need to be Welsh? It's a blessing that he doesn't need to be Welsh. And then if you accept that he does need to be Welsh, there were Welsh managers at the time who since have proved themselves to be very good managers. Tony Pulis, for example. We probably could have got him at the time that Hughes left. Brian Flynn would be a step backwards. Brian Flynn, I have a lot of regard for. He managed Swansea. And that's not why I had regard for him. People are very fond of him down there. He's a very, very nice man.
He's done a good job with the under-21s.
He has done a good job with the under-21s, but I wouldn't give him too much credit for that. In that, people say that him, well, they say it about Toshak as well. They've brought a lot of young players through. They didn't bring the young players through. Southampton brought Gareth Bale through. Cardiff brought Aaron Ramsey through. All they did was pick them. And why wouldn't you pick them? Because there wasn't anybody else who was better than them. And so I don't think it's not the same as England, where you've got a bunch of incumbent, very famous professionals and you're replacing them with kids. You've got, in some cases, League One or League Two players and you're replacing them with kids. But you would replace them with kids when the kids are clearly better footballers. Mm. So I don't give him too much credit for either of those two things.
I mean, it's got a question here from one of our listeners, Nick Thompson, said, what is Toshak's exact legacy after all these years?
Well, you have to say we've gone backwards. And it's a shame, in terms of international managers, you know, he managed Real Madrid and all the rest of it. He did very well at Swansea early in his career and he was a great footballer. But if anything, if this is his last job, then, you know, it's not what people in Wales will remember him for, and that's not great. And that's the real thing about the new job. Because we haven't qualified for a tournament since 1958, if somebody were able to manage to do it, and I promise you nobody cares where that person's from, They forevermore. I could not describe in words how much love and passion the Welsh people would have for that person. The Welsh people are soft anyway. They love.
I mean, you look at the rugby team. It's often managed by an Antipodean.
Well, it has been, and nobody particularly minds that. You know, certain committees behind closed doors, they don't like them. They might say, oh, you know, he's an English so and so. They only say those things when things are going wrong. Otherwise, you know, they're quite happy to accept that. Ultimately, they'll adopt people who do good things for them, of course. And so, I mean, lots of the players aren't Welsh. Yeah. So why does the manager need to be?
Very true. So let's get on to that manager. Bringing Chris as a neutral observer, who would you have?
Well, I wouldn't have one of the names that's been floating around, and not for the obvious reason, that's Robbie Savage, who I have seen numerous people mention in relationship with this role. But despite the only 90 minutes I've seen him play in the flesh over the last few years being absolutely appalling at QPR last season, he's probably still got a playing job, hasn't he?
He's got a playing job, he's got a media job. I mean, he's actually played very well for Derby this season.
Would he play for Wales? I think he probably would.
Well, he stopped playing because of Toshack.
He'd come back, wouldn't he, surely?
He is, and he's one of the few, actually, with a bit of what's in Wales we call hoyle. He's got this dog in him, basically. He loves Wales, and he likes playing for Wales. Bellamy does. But lots of them are indifferent to it.
Well, I mean, one of the first people who's put his name forward is John Hartson, who has that in abundance. How would you feel about Big John?
Well, I love Big John. I really love Big John. I actually played in the same club as him. He was in the year ahead of me at Llanlas Boys Club. And Big John is a hero of mine. I know lots of sort of anecdotes about him. I like him as a person. He still watches the Swans. He queues up and buys a ticket. He could easily take advantage of hospitality. He takes his kids down there. John is a warm, wonderful, big man who is a great footballer and a great gentleman. I don't know whether he's got all the things you need to be a successful international manager, but I don't think he needs all the things that you need.
What's worked for Wales lately?
Well, that's a good question. What has worked?
Over the last 10 years, the managers that have worked would suggest that what they should be looking at now is probably Chris Coleman or John Hartson.
I completely agree with you. I think Coleman more than Hartson. But your starting point actually is that we couldn't afford somebody better than both of them, right?
True.
In terms of people who are likely to take the job, I think Chris Coleman, who again is an absolute hero of mine, would be a great appointment. And I take Hartson as well because, well, you know, what are the ingredients of success? Talent? There's loads of talent. There's never been as much talent in Welsh football as there is now. The second thing is organisation. You don't have that much. It's not like the English FA. They don't, you know, when Mark Hughes first got the job, one of the first things he did was made them wear blazers and made them stay in the same hotel and got them to travel together. It was simple things, but there were things that they weren't doing previously. And it did make a difference. But you got to live with the organisation. You know, it is what it is. Tactics, just assume for a second that, you know, we'll afford somebody who is a reasonable tactician. And the final one is motivation. You want somebody who the players want to play for, like, and can create a sense of unity.
And you can see that in both Hartson and Coleman for me.
You can absolutely see it in Hartson and Coleman. You could see it in Hughes. Hughes had it in abundance. Everywhere he managed, his players liked him. He's the only person who could manage Robbie Savage and Craig Bellamy. You know, Craig Bellamy has failed, basically, with almost every other manager who's tried to manage him. He loved Mark Hughes. He would have done anything for him. And that is what we need. And we need it more than most countries. Going back to Scotland and Irish and stuff like this, the Scottish side is predominantly Scottish. Wales is, especially in football, when football isn't even the national sport, it's a weirdly divided country. And it's divided by the fact that a lot of the players have basically, you know, they don't live in Wales. Like, our rugby players live in Wales. Most of them are married to Welsh girls. Most, you know, it doesn't matter on a sort of a racial side of things. What I'm getting at is it gives them a sense of patriotism that is absent if you left Wales when you were 13 or you've never actually, you know, been there at all. The other thing it's massively divided by, and this is in football and outside of football, is geography. It's one of the few countries where there's nothing in the middle. There's no such thing as a mid-Welsher or a mid-Waleser. You're either from the north or you're from the south. And culturally, geographically, everything, people in the south of Wales do not have much in common with people in the north. There's no roads between them. If I wanted to travel from Swansea to Rhyl, I would go to Bristol, I'd go up the M5, I'd go via Chester, and I'd go back in. Like, culturally, they're different. And so what you need is, because in that sense, they're a group of mercenaries almost. you know, they represent different things. And what you need is one man in the middle who they love and who they enjoy spending time with. And so they'll come back and they'll say, they'll go back to Man United or Arsenal or wherever they play, and they'll say, I went to Latvia on Wednesday, and hopefully some of the England internationals will say, what was it like? And they'll say, it was brilliant. It was the best week. You know, I spent time with this bloke and this bloke. You know, we did this. Jack Charlton did it with Ireland in the 1980s. You could see, you know, he's wearing stupid baseball caps. They're all hugging him when he scored. They were all from all over the place as well. But he managed to instill this sense of unity. And that is what Wales need, because the players are good enough. And so look at the group. You do not need to be that good to beat some of those sides.
We say it a lot in here, don't we? The Welsh talent at the moment is pretty good, and it should be good enough to at least get a playoff spot in that group. There are obviously tough teams in there, hopefully England being one of them, which should make it difficult. But second spot should not be out of reach for a team with that amount of talent.
Two quick questions on the manager before we wrap up for this half. I'll go to Chris on this one first. A lot of people, and John Toshak himself, have been touting Ryan Giggs for the job. Where do you stand on that?
I think that the likes of Giggs and Hartson would be good shouts in a situation where Chris Coleman didn't exist. As it happens, they have the Giggs and the Hartson character with some managerial experience as well. For me, he's the absolute standout candidate.
For me, Tim, as well, Giggs feels a bit too early, even in his career, because he still seems very much part of it at Manchester United.
He does, and I don't think he has the character, actually. I think they would respect him because of the standard he's played at and the places he's been and the things he's achieved. But if you sat him next to John Hartson, I've never met Ryan Giggs, but, you know, John Hartson's a motor-mouth. John Hartson is somebody who, you know, lives his life with a smile on his face. I can imagine him motivating people to play at the best of their abilities. Ryan Giggs, not so much. I don't think he's that sort of personality. He wouldn't be that sort of manager. He might go on to become a better manager than Hartson in a different situation. But at this situation, what we need is a character that the players love. And John Hartson would tick all of those boxes. That said, Chris Coleman would too, and he has managerial experience. And therefore, I would put Coleman in. Maybe put both of them in. First, why not put both of them in? The other thing I've wondered is whether it needs to be a full-time job. The days of Pop...
Well, Hughes was still playing when he first took it.
Correct. Yeah. I wonder whether, you know, setting aside whether you take someone who's player-manager, whether you could manage a club and manage a country like Wales, where I imagine, for example, there are far less meetings than there are at Lancaster Gate.
I once did it in Championship Manager, so it must be possible. One quick one to throw out there. You said it doesn't matter who it is. One name I have heard, you know, it's kind of one of those... You'd kind of not entirely surprised to hear his name, even though he is English. How would you feel if, say, Dave Jones took over?
Not happy. Well, that's different, isn't it? I think Dave Jones is a fairly old-fashioned football manager. And I think he's sort of struggled to succeed, really. You know, Cardiff at the moment, success is promotion. And he's had a lot, you know, he's had a lot of money like thrown at him. I think he's much more from the sort of John Toshak vein than he is than say I might have said on the pod before. Roberto Martinez is a fantastic football manager. If Roberto Martinez is not a better football manager than Dave Jones, I will eat that plastic bottle. So if you're going to take somebody like that, why not take Martinez or somebody and get them to do it part time?
Do they almost need someone young? Because it was the mistake with Toshak was changing a winning formula, wasn't it? I mean, they were doing okay under young managers who had, you know, they were Welsh primarily, but also they had the respect of the players, and they were almost part of the team. They were coming out of the top end of the team, and then suddenly Toshak's in there, and it changed. So why not go back to what was working?
I completely agree with you. I think they need to be young, but they have to have played at a certain level. I think because of the likes of having Bellamy and Bale in the team, someone like Brian Flynn, for example, who actually has played at a level, so he's the wrong age. But there are people who are younger. I don't know, Paul Trollope, for example. who I think might struggle to get to gain the real sort of like credibility of somebody like a Hartson who has been there and done it, or a Coleman who's been there and done it. You know, he's managed Premier League footballers. He knows how to deal with a big ego and a big salary. You know, he's used to it.
Very quickly before we finish, name from or both of you, who would you have your choice
with? So realistically, with the salary, you can't have anybody. Chris Coleman.
Chris?
Yeah, Tim's talked me around. I would have Coleman and Hartson.
Coleman and Hartson.
Oh, yeah. Just imagine. Both
Coleman's my first choice, but I think that would be a very interesting model.
I put it out on Twitter as well before I came. Matt Roger, who's one of our new writers on Two Footed Tackle, said he says Chris Coleman as well. And my choice would be Coleman or Hartson, or even Kenny Jackett as well.
Well, Jackett, you see, first, Jackett, when he was at Swansea, did remarkably well, and he did it at Millwall as well. But what he didn't do was sign well, but that doesn't matter in an international setup. So what he did was he got the best out of the players that he had, which is fantastic skill. The big issue is he hasn't managed at the very highest level, whereas Coleman has. And so I think Coleman would be just that better equipped to deal with, as I say, a bigger... Like Kenny Jackett, you know, God bless Millwall and Swansea, has never had... £100,000 a week footballer sitting in his dressing room. He's never managed at that sort of level. It's not to say he couldn't. He's still relatively young. So he's a fantastic manager. But I think that we need somebody with a little bit more, where the name is slightly bigger.
Okay, right. Well, we'll leave it there for Wales. If you've got an opinion, if you disagree, I know there's a few Welsh listeners we've got out there who want Coleman, some want Giggs. Just have your say. Twofootedtackle.com. Leave comments after the podcast or go to our Facebook page, twofootedtackle.com. Facebook.com/twofootedtackle. Tim and I are just off to pop our applications in the post for a Welsh manager's job. That's assuming Phil Brown doesn't actually beat us to it. In the meantime, Chris will be boning up on MLS and we'll be sharing the non-league love around. Part 2 of the Two Footed Tackle podcast with Chris Nee, Gary Andrews and Tim Morgan. And it's MLS time. Chris, who's been doing what this week in US soccer ball?
Well, Real Salt Lake have been catching LA Galaxy at the top of the West. So they're now a point behind the Galaxy. And if we're looking at Supporters Shield, a point behind the Crew as well. Fantastic season for Real Salt Lake after obviously they won the whole thing last year after finishing the regular season with a losing record. But they're almost earning that title this season.
Absolutely. And Galaxy held to a 1-1 draw. I mean, they had a very late goal after they were 1-1 against Chicago. And Chicago, man down for 70 minutes,
yeah. And then two late goals, one for Collins John. And then a stoppage time equaliser from Omar Gonzalez. And that's the Galaxy now haven't won in, I think, three games.
They're stuttering a bit, aren't they?
They are a little bit. And they're being punished for it as well, because RSL are really coming up on the rails and the Crew are just kind of matching them step for step in the other division as well.
No renaissance from DC though.
No, surprisingly not.
Losing 1-0 to Columbus Crew. We were talking just before we came on air about how poor Houston Dynamo have been this season, because you thought they'd dip, but you didn't think they'd be quite as bad as they have been, losing 2-1 to San Jose Earthquakes.
Yeah, so they lost their engine room during the transfer window before the season started, with Stuart Holden obviously coming to England and Rico Clark heading for Germany. And it was always going to cause some issues for them. And I personally thought that they would be much higher up the table than they are despite that. But they've continued to slip and they're now second bottom in the West. Short of a miracle, and they won't be going into the playoffs.
And just round up the other results. Dallas got a good win against Toronto. I mean, Toronto are now looking like they're probably going to be in the playoffs, aren't they?
Yeah, Toronto shaping up reasonably nicely. The East is the much weaker conference, as we say every week, but Toronto are third in that, and it would be highly kind of unusual for only two teams to go in from the one conference. So Toronto in the box seat for that place as well, with the Wizards are right on top of them, and Chicago now chasing them as well.
Absolutely. And then... the Rapids look like they're sort of sitting reasonably sort of comfortably in the Western Conference, and a good win for them against Chivas as well, 3-0, a couple of goals from Cummings.
Yeah, they should be okay for the playoffs. I think the watermark was about 38 points last season to get in, and they're on 34 at the moment, so they should be fine. Connor Casey, Omar Cummings are key players for them. Chivas are very, very poor, so not a surprising result in the least.
Mm. And of the big game, I guess, this week coming up is Galaxy against Columbus Crew. Mm. Now, which way could you see that one going? Because it's a really, you know, Galaxy at home, but the Crew are a very, very strong side.
Yeah, they are, and not just on form. I would say the Crew haven't been winning game after game after game, but I think that they probably have the edge despite being on the road.
Mm. Well, if anybody happens to be up at 3:30 American to LA time, so I think that's 3:30 in the morning our time, actually.
That's our time,
our time. If anybody happens to be up, and that's probably a good game to catch or record somewhere.
If you're going to stay up over the weekend, I'd say have a look at Real Salt Lake, because they're doing very well, but they're slightly unsung in terms of how entertaining they are, and I think they're a fantastic team to watch.
They've got a tough game, haven't they, against the Sounders?
They have. Sounders stumbled a bit. They've been kind of picking up a little bit of form, as we mentioned last week, but they lost at New England over the weekend, so a little bit of a little slight dip there, and a tough game for them at the weekend.
Mm, I think one which perhaps isn't necessarily heralded, but it could be quite an interesting one. San Jose Earthquakes against Dallas, I think, could be quite an interesting game.
Yeah, Dallas, my probably self-proclaimed second club a little bit. I love watching them for no particular reason, but they're always good fun. And the Earthquakes, obviously, with Giovanni coming into the fold now as well, they've been doing pretty well. They're relatively good to watch. They've been picking up some good results, and they're in decent form.
Mm, other ones as well. DC have got Toronto. Do you see a win there?
Nope.
Okay. New York Red Bulls against the Rapids. That's, again, I mean, Rapids are a good side.
Yes, they are very good. They're probably, you know, pretty much in the playoffs now, I would say. So New York win.
New York win.
the Rapids will give them a good game, but obviously the star quality that they have in New York now should give them the edge in any predictions.
I guess you've got to say, if the Fire want to get into the playoffs, they need to beat the likes of Philadelphia Union, who they've got this week.
Certainly do. They're beginning to fall short. They're making a little go of it, but they are essentially going to have to catch probably sort of around the area of San Jose, different divisions, but they're going to need to finish above those couple of teams there. They're going to struggle, I think. And the Union, not the best, but certainly no mugs.
And I mean, the same, I guess, you've got to go for the Wizards, who need to beat the Dynamo this weekend if they're going to be still continuing to chase that dream of a playoff spot.
Yeah, obviously DC can do them a favour by beating Toronto, but I can't see that happening. But yeah, the Wizards are in touch there, so they probably have a chance there. Obviously, got some excellent players at the top end of the field there, so they're capable of nicking a goal or two.
Excellent. Okay, well, we'll leave that there for MLS this week. Got any MLS questions, do fire them at Chris to twitter.com/2footedtackle, and I'm sure we'll be happy to answer them, and we might even bring up a few next week. Okay, let's go back to this country for a bit now. The big question is, what game did you watch last weekend? If you were one of the thousands who popped along to a non-league game, well done, for last weekend was non-league day, where fans of Premier League and Championship clubs were encouraged to get down and support their local team. If you listened to the pod last week, we had Caroline Barker from the Non-League show espousing everything that was good about non-league. We had James Doe, the founder of Non-League Day, on the phone as well. Chris, where did you head to?
I went to the delightful Way Court to watch Godalming Town's fixture in the Ryman South against Chipstead.
And what? How did that end? What was it like down at Godalming?
It was pretty good. It was 0-0. It was a decent 0-0. There were a few chances. Both teams played relatively well. Judging by our brief conversation with Glenn Moulton from Godalming last week, to their strengths, Chipstead were robust. They really struggled when they were playing the long ball, which they did far too much in the first half. And the two lads at the back just headed everything out for the home team. Chipstead better in the second half. Their goalkeeper was absolutely superb. Possibly had a bit of a tendency to punch when he didn't need to, but very decent game, quite entertaining. Looked like a reasonable crowd, although it was boosted probably more by a stag do than it was by non-league day, which we were sat right behind, because I had Mrs. TFT with me, so we sat in the stands.
Oh, posh, get you.
Yeah, on the horrible green benches. But it's fantastic. It was just a proper little non-league ground. you can change ends, you can walk round, you can hear the players shouting the most obscene things at supporters. And it was a very entertaining afternoon, and cheap too.
Excellent. Tim, I don't actually know if you were at a non-league game this weekend. Did you make it or not?
Sadly, I didn't, Gary. I wanted to. It's interesting what Chris was saying about Mrs. TFT, because obviously at Pick Live, we work with football, we work around the football schedule. It means that I find myself, basically working a lot while there's football on. And when they're not, then I like to go and watch. And obviously the Swans weren't playing and stuff. And so I couldn't find a way to persuade Mrs. M to go and watch our local side, which might even have been Tooting and Mitcham, something like that. We live in Wandsworth.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, Tooting and Mitcham, Collierswood United.
Yeah. You got our standards, though.
I didn't manage it. Sometimes she comes to the football with me. She won't go and watch the Swans with me. She's from Barry. Barry Town are a very good non-league side. Very good non-league side, actually.
Big name back in the day, weren't they?
They were. Well, yeah, they played in Europe quite a lot. And they play a place called Jenna Park, which is by no means a true non-league ground. You see what I mean? It wouldn't look out of place in the bottom division, I don't think. And going back to Wales again, I think Newport County are doing very well this season. If I had gone, I'd have gone down there. Or maybe Neath, who have signed Lee Trundle, which beggars belief, actually. I don't know how they were able to afford his salary.
After saying that there wasn't a deal in the offing and he was just training with them.
Yeah,
popped along there. Yeah, I mean, Chris, you've got to say, it's been a good weekend, because you hear reports all over the place of, certainly in the Ryman League, attendances rose, and that's subtle level where you really start to see that difference being made by the extra 10, 20, 30, yeah, 40 through the gates.
It sounds like it's gone really well. It's interesting that the Ryman League is the one that's kind of seems to have had the biggest benefit, because it'd be interesting to see how many people who went to those games were outsiders from the kind of the London and surrounds, people like us who have adopted teams that we can get to easily and went along to those, whereas the Samaretto and the Southern League might be a little bit different, possibly.
I mean, also, as well, you
those talk, are the same thing.
Hang you on. Talk about the...
the Northern and the Southern League.
Samaretto and Evo Stick. When we're talking about non-league as well, it's the conference has got so professionalised. Now, you look at the names in the conference, and, you know, Grimsby, to me, don't necessarily seem like a non-league team. York still don't, to me, seem like a non-league team as well. You've got teams like that in there. Do you think that's why people perhaps might well have gone down a level or two, going, well, you know, I know those names. I might have been to that ground already with my club. So, you know, I'm going to drop down the league.
Possibly. I haven't heard anything about the top sort of two levels, how they did out of it. They must have done all right.
I would have thought they'd
probably stuck a few hundred on the gates.
Yeah, like a Luton Town, for example. Yeah. I mean, they do pretty well anyway. I'd be interested to see how many they get.
Because it's very much sort of step three and below that we're talking about and hearing about over the last week since it actually happened. And it'd be interesting to see how the conference teams did.
Well, I mean, that's the other thing about it. There isn't a great deal of difference sometimes in terms of the infrastructure and the wealth between the bottom of League Two, for example, and the top of the conference. So I think quite rightly, Chris, you know, you focus below that level.
And because there's also like that slight oddness as well. One couple of teams that's slightly odd. I always find it sort of slightly strange that Colwyn Bay and Merthyr Tydfil have stayed. Obviously, there was that whole history when the Welsh Premier League was created, but Colwyn Bay and Merthyr Tydfil still ploughing away in those levels.
Part of it was legacy. Merthyr, for example, were in the conference at the time, and for a while, it looked like they would do okay. They had money. There's a big Hoover factory in Merthyr, if you knew that. but they were sponsored, basically, by Hoover. I think their ground was sponsored by the shirt sponsor, and so they were able to develop good players. Now, inevitably, it being a South Wales Valley, the Hoover factory isn't there anymore, and so the bottom drops out of the club. But by then they're in a league and they have a structure there. So they just kind of went down. Newport obviously going the other way, I think, has been good for them. And you know, I'm glad they don't play in the League of Wales. I think Newport County is a proper league club. It's certainly as much a league club as Wimbledon is historically. So. Yeah, it's just in terms of attendances. The average attendance, I think, in the league was about 250.
And you get a lot more in that in conference. Because, was in Wales for 5 years, lived there, and I made it to one one League of Wales game at Cwmbran.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was an experience, and it felt, you know, although this is Wales' Premier League, it felt very much like, you know, a very non-league game.
Well, that's very true. I mean, the competition down there for sport on a Saturday afternoon, take someone like Cwmbran, for example. It's strange because Cwmbran's pretty close to Swansea, but I remember when we used to go on Swansea away trips, the bus would start in Swansea, but we'd always stop in Cwmbran and pick up a bunch of Swansea City fans who happened to live there, who collectively were known as the Cwmbran Jacks. So even a side like that, you know, most people in South Wales support Swansea or Cardiff if they're going to go and watch football. And if they don't go and watch football, then they go and watch rugby. You know, the Ospreys can get 12 or 15,000 on Saturday afternoon. So the competition is very high for what are often sports fans. Like, they do like football, they know a lot about football, but they have these options. You can see rugby at the very highest level 5 miles down the road, or you can watch football, which, as you say, is at a very, you know, pretty low level. And that doesn't mean they prefer rugby to football. It's just affected by, you know, what the stadium's like, the
quality
food and the quality on offer and everything else. So it's complicated down there.
Of course, there were the successes, but Chris, there's been a couple of sad tales this week. If you go on to twofootedtackle.com, the redesigned, very shiny new twofootedtackle.com, you'll see a report from Terry DeFellin on there on his non-league day at Croydon Athletic, who, they are still going, Chris, but only just. And, yeah. I mean, very, very emotional day down there at Croydon.
Yeah, so they lost, I think it was 3-1, wasn't it, to Concord. Effectively, the manager in the whole of the first team said goodbye afterwards. Obviously, we spoke a little bit about why that would be last week.
For anybody who hasn't heard it, it's connected with the Pakistani match-fixing scandal, and their chairman is the main man who was caught up in the News of the World sting. Assets have been frozen. So, yeah, I mean,
It's got worse than today as well, hasn't it? Well, it hasn't necessarily got worse, but it's been made clear exactly how serious their situation is today, the news that they may fold, which would be just tragic as it is in any case. But it's strange, because I would years ago this would have slightly passed me by a little bit, but now supporting a team in that league and knowing people like Terry who go and watch them regularly, it's quite close to home. It's quite
well.
Weird
the next game
watch.
Was against Tooting.
Yeah, I was hoping to go down there earlier this week and watch us give their whatever ragtag bunch they could find off the streets of Croydon a good thrashing. But sadly, that wasn't to be.
Mrs. TFT will be quite happy then.
She was delighted, yeah.
The other one as well is Ilkeston Town from the Conference North, who, I mean, they've been suffering sort of financial troubles ever since they got up there. And their chairman, his business empire collapsed with lots of debts, and they've had to take over. I mean, but the conference knew that they were in financial trouble, yet let them start the season. And, you know, we're now, six, seven games in. And those six, seven teams who've played Ilkeston and who've actually beaten Ilkeston, not all of them have. That just seems. I mean, it's better that they've collapsed. Probably now, not that it's ever good that they have, but for the league, probably better now than the end of the season, like Chester did last year. But it still kind of strikes as a slightly odd thing.
On that basis, to drag it back to Croydon briefly, it's, I think, worrying that. That they weren't just forfeiting the two games that they've cancelled from that league, that those games were postponed and the teams they were going to play haven't been given any points. I think that is a bad omen for the future for them, because I think that suggests that the games that they have played are being prepared to be expunged. It's in both cases, it's obviously very, very sad. As you said, the Ilkeston thing is not new. Were they in a position to not let them start the season?
What's so unhealthy about it, though, is if you say that the economic success of the club is directly connected to the owner's business, for example. It shouldn't really be the case, and there's a real shame, actually, regarding money and fashion, really, that it's become fashionable for businessmen, business owners, to own football clubs. And so if you're Abramovich, you get a very big one in the Premiership. If you're not quite Abramovich, but you're reasonably successful, you might be able to score yourself a Championship one. And so it goes down. And so they can say, you know, at dinner parties, somebody who runs, you know, the local tile centre, who himself might be worth 900 grand or something like this, can tell people that he owns a football club. And, you know, isn't it wonderful? And that sort of fashion for people who are sort of self-made to buy a football club, and then for the success or the future of that football club to be so intrinsically linked to that person's business. You know, lots of people fail in business. There needs to be a gap at all levels. Otherwise, we're going to see more of it. One thing I'm interested in, and be very interested in your view on it, is whether or not these clubs are allowed to go to the wall more readily than league clubs.
Well, I mean, it's interesting you say that, because the next club that was up in court, same day as Ilkeston, it was Sheffield Wednesday, who are very, very close geographically. Yeah. And Sheffield Wednesday, I think, are also fairly insolvent, is fair to say. Yet they were got backing from the bank at the last minute. You know, it touch and go whether they were going to be put into administration or not, but they got through. Ilkeston didn't. They said, you know, we have a player who we're going to sell for at least a bit of money to be able to clear some of the debts, and we've got plans in place for that. That didn't happen. But yeah, I mean, you do get a lot of league clubs do spend time in court. Cardiff, obviously, very big case, and Portsmouth as well. Now, I think that if you were at non-league level, these clubs would probably not have made it through, because it does seem that, you know, it's easier to... You'll always get people rally round these big clubs. You see what happened with Southampton as well. They were very, very, very close to going
out.
Can't
be allowed to fail, yeah, is the notion of it.
Portsmouth was a funny one, wasn't it? Because it was, everybody obviously didn't want them to go out of business. But if you look at it from a pure kind of taxman's point of view, I guess, it was an absolute scandal that they were allowed to carry on. A football club, obviously, we're all delighted that they did, and it feels like it's justice because we wanted them to survive.
But actually, then it's your tax money,
exactly,
my tax money.
You look at the numbers, they shouldn't have been allowed to continue.
And not just the tax money. If I was a debtor of some of these clubs, especially the ones that continue to pay people tens of thousands of pounds a week while they're in administration, and I'm owed maybe £8,000 because I helped put a stand up there once, and I'm a plumber or something, and I hadn't been paid for 9 months, I'd be absolutely furious. That is my livelihood.
The debtors are usually in there. The likes of St John's Ambulance frequently appear.
Correct.
And you look at that and you just think, yeah, I mean, in Portsmouth's case, they actually rallied round, the fans rallied round to pay off the St John's Ambulance debt, because I think if that was my club and I saw that on there, I would be ashamed. Yeah. I would be ashamed to be associated with a club that owed an organisation like St John's Ambulance money.
St John's Ambulance have got plenty cash.
They're volunteers.
I take your point.
It's one of those things.
Serious money. I think the pocket pies people are the more worrying.
I think maybe Chris has audited the St John's Ambulance. He seems very confident about their wealth. But the one club that I think sort of falls between the two stools is Chester City, because obviously, in anybody who's an adult, living memory, they were a league side and they were allowed to fail when they were in the conference. Yeah, if they'd have been in League One in exactly the same situation, what would have happened?
That would have been fascinating. I mean, we haven't got time to get into Chester, but so many sort of things that were wrong with that club. How they managed to limp on for as long as they did, it is quite frankly absolutely staggering. If you are interested in Chester, I'd probably encourage you to have a read of 200%.net, which is Ian King's site. He detailed Chester's demise all throughout last season. That's well worth a read if we've piqued your interest.
Scathing about Portsmouth surviving as well.
Very scathing. It was very scathing about Sheffield Wednesday surviving as well today. I think that's Mark Murphy who might have been writing on that rather than Ian. But yeah, anyway, part two, we're going to wind up, sadly, like so many other football clubs. Part three involves the Premier League. We've not talked about for over 2 weeks. Actually feels kind of strangely liberating, it has to be said. Well, we'll have to rectify that, and that'll be rectified after this. Welcome back to part three of the Two Footed Tackle podcast. Back on more familiar territory here. Well, slightly. Let's start off with a quick question from our listeners. Two Unfortunate on Twitter asked, where does Scunthorpe go from here? Of course, for those of you who don't perhaps know what's going on, Scunthorpe were, their manager Nigel Adkins was approached by Southampton to take the vacancy there. The chairman said, you should resign if you want to go there. And he said, no, I want Southampton to pay a decent level of compensation to the club before I consider going. Which, Tim, is fairly unusual in football these days, isn't it?
It's very decent, isn't it? And hats off to him. I mean, I thought he was a good football manager before this, but now I think he's a terrific one. If every manager of one of the smaller clubs had such an attitude, then I think they'd all be doing a lot better than they are. So, I've got a lot of respect for that. I think that's a great thing for him to have done. You can't, when you're in that situation, somebody asked me this season about how I felt about Paulo Sousa going from Leicester to Swansea, that's in the same division, but it's effectively a bigger club poaching your manager. You have to let them go. You have to understand that he, you know, he's a man who has ambition and all the rest of it, so why shouldn't he be allowed to do it? But this is something that he can do for his club, the club that presumably has stood by him, given him a chance and all the rest of it. So yeah, hats off to him.
Absolutely. And Chris, where do Scunthorpe go from here? They've had a decent start to the season in the Championship, again confounding expectations, one of the smaller clubs up there. Southampton, a kind of a behemoth, if you like, in League One. Where does Scunthorpe go?
It's going to be a battle for them this season, as you would have expected before this, but it's be just interesting to see how much of a wobble this is going to cause, because presumably he would, in an ideal world, have liked to have gone. It may not do. You know, his gesture may keep him in favour there. The owner presumably isn't too displeased with it. The fans will be chuffed about it. So it probably isn't going to have too much of an effect on their season. So be the same as was. I'm from an Adkins family.
Really? No, yeah. I didn't know that. Yeah. Any relation?
Not as far as I know. Okay. I don't think so. I'm sure it would have been mentioned, what with me being a renowned family football obsessive. But no, I don't think he is a relation. But yes, it's my mum's maiden name. Yeah. And nobody will be able to get into my bank accounts with that, because I've made up my answer to that question.
Excellent. Okay, fair enough.
Speaking of Leicester City, didn't they have a goalkeeper called Ian Andrews once?
Birmingham. Didn't I? I think it was Birmingham. There has been. The Andrews are few and far between in football. There's Keith Andrews, obviously, Blackburn. And, I struggle to think of too many other ones, which is surprising, because you think it's actually roots are in Scottish. Although I can't trace any Scottish in my family, not for a fair bit. And the roots are son of Andrews, Scottish name. Not very many of us around. Not in football, at any rate.
Maybe there's some sort of genetic mutation for footballers in the Andrews family.
Well, quite possibly. It certainly hasn't landed on me, that's for sure. Okay, right. Premier League. Let's get back to that. It returns after the international break. Probably the biggest story. Villa have come back with a new manager, one Gerard Houllier. How do you feel about that, Mr. Nee?
About the appointment or your pronunciation?
Both. My pronunciation is shocking. The appointment is that shocking.
I've said this before about another club that I follow and a slightly left field managerial appointment, and I'm cautiously optimistic. The options that Villa had weren't that great, I don't think. I presume that we made moves for managers that we didn't get. I would suggest that there was probably more involvement with the likes of Mark Hughes and Martin Yole than has been made public. But the decision quite early on was made to go for somebody who wasn't in employment. Obviously didn't turn out to be true. But, you know, Alan Kirby, Alan Pardew, Phil Brown.
Phil Brown.
You know, I'd take Julio over all of these guys. And I would take him over Martin O'Neill. So, you know, all in all, I'm pretty optimistic. His transfer policy is going to take some work. But if he can bring the skills that have obviously helped him out in a very technical role with the French Football Federation, I think it can be only good for us.
And of course, where did you stand on whether Kevin McDonald should have got the job or not? And do you still want him at the club?
Yeah, I want him at the club. He's a very good coach. He's incredibly popular with his players. I do want him there. I wouldn't be opposed to him being assistant manager or first team coach. I wouldn't have been in favour of having him as the manager and bringing in a director of football. I'm not convinced about that model, and I would be worried about McDonald as the Premier League manager. I don't think he's quite at that level.
Okay. Well, you've got Stoke City. You're the Monday night game, Villa. God. That's a tough one, isn't it? Baptism of fire for Gerard.
It's going to be bloody freezing that game, the Britannia, in that weather.
Weather aside,
very, very tough. Stoke, I don't think, have got off to the best start, have they? So they will be looking to pick up a win in a fixture that has some decent memories for them in the Premier League. I think we're going to find it difficult, and I wouldn't be surprised to see us lose. But, you know, maybe the old new manager bounce will give us a bit of momentum.
It's fascinating times at Villa. Fascinating times. I'm not quite sure how you've managed to end up at fourth in the table, even though it's only three games in. But
I'm optimistic that we're not skint, which was the only sort of post O'Neill worry that is what would have given me some issues.
Well, you have to say, don't you, that O'Neill leaves, there's then a gap, at the time, it felt like Villa were, you know, plunging into crisis. Mm. I think if you sort of said, well, this is going to last 3-4 weeks, however long it's lasted, you're going to be fourth after three games and you're going to get Gerard Houllier. Mm.
Pleased.
Yeah.
I was kind of comfortable with it all, because as has been well documented on the show and on the blog, I'm not exactly sad to see the back of Martin O'Neill. And I still give my full backing to Randy Lerner and the board, but just a nagging feeling that maybe I was wrong. And had we appointed Kevin McDonald or Pardew or Kerbishley, I would have become convinced that I'd been wrong and that we were doing things on the cheap. As it happens, yes, there is a financial issue at the club. It's rooted in the waste to turnover ratio. The board's word is that O'Neill wasn't willing or, you know, capable of bringing that into sensible levels. He went after a falling out. We've got somebody in who presumably we're paying better than we would be paying somebody else. So I'm pretty happy all round, to be honest. And I think that he'll be able to cut the wage bill down. We don't have to sell our big players. We've sold big players over the last two summers because the realities of football are that Manchester City and the like are going to come along and poach your best players. That's not a reflection on the wage bill or anything else at the club. It's a reflection on where Man City are and what they can do with their money. We can get rid of players who are on big wages who don't play. And we can play players who are on big wages and don't play and should be playing. And that's why getting rid of O'Neill is going to be a blessing, I think, for us.
I've just put Luke Young in my fantasy team, so I'm hoping that Julio's going to play him regularly. And it's good news for you as well. Well, I say good news. Stephen Sidwell's back from injury.
Who?
One manager who is going to be ruining the international break, Tim, Harry Redknapp. He's lost Michael Dawson to what looked like a very nasty knee injury, and Jermaine Defoe as well, out for not quite sure how long, but out with an ankle injury. I mean, those are two key players for Spurs. Now, perhaps you might be exaggerating, say they're down to their bare bones. I'm sure Harry might argue differently, but that's two big losses for Spurs. They've got West Brom, so I guess not a bad side if you're going to be playing without two of your key players. But even so, I mean, that losses for Spurs.
Yeah, there have been some losses. I think Spurs have got a decent depth, though. Like at centre-half, for example, there's sort of three or four people who have played regularly for Tottenham in the last two or three years. You know, obviously people like Ledley King has difficulty playing every game. But I think that... So Dawson would be a loss, but not, you know, the difference between them finishing in the Champions League positions or not. Defoe, I think, is more important to what they're able to achieve there. I think on song, and I think Defoe quite likes playing at Tottenham more than he's enjoyed playing other places. I think he could be the difference between them finishing the top four. So a lot depends on his ability, you know, to come back quickly and you know, to be relatively fit. I think Redknapp has signed well again, obviously late in the transfer window.
He was congratulating himself on signing William Gallas the other day. He was like, that was a very good signing and it's looking even better now.
Well, it certainly is. And I don't know, Tottenham are looking like a side... I think Tottenham are going to finish in the top four, and I think Manchester City are going to finish in the top four, I think that might create problems for Arsenal.
Really? I wonder if it might create problems for Manchester United, personally. Hmm. But anyway, Manchester United have got Everton, Chris, which is, it's a tough test for anybody to go to Goodison, and obviously Moyes has done does a fantastic job up there. That's the early kickoff, that's the first one of the weekend. Where do you see that one going?
I think Everton's traditional start is probably going to hinder them here. They don't start well. They should have beaten Villa. I mean, we looked actually from the highlights that we had the best chances, but I was kind of keeping an eye on what was going on online on the day, and it sounded like we took an absolute pummeling, although Everton didn't really break us down. I think United have started reasonably well. They obviously had that sort of one blip. I think a United win, but keep an eye on the blog today, as it will be, for a little feature looking back over the last five times that United have been to Goodison in the league.
Oh, okay. Well, we will keep eyes peeled, indeed.
They haven't had it all their own way.
No, indeed. It's one that you certainly think say is a tough fixture. And talking of tough fixtures, Arsenal at home, Tim, but they've got Bolton, and that's the kind of team that... You know, complete contrast in styles. Although Owen Coyle's got Bolton playing a little bit more away from the traditional Bolton style of recent years.
Maybe, and Owen Coyle is a very good manager, but ultimately they're still Bolton. There are certain clubs in that division who, you know, they're to somebody who doesn't support a Premiership side, there is a certain joy to watching Arsenal. I don't have a soft spot for them. I've just said they're not going to finish in the top four, but you know, you do appreciate the way that they play, and Bolton are a long way from being a really entertaining side. So Arsenal, I think, will just have too much for them. So I think Arsenal will beat them. That said, Owen Coyle has done a good job at Bolton Wanderers, and I don't think there'll be any sniff of them being in the relegation zone towards the end of the season. I think he's a good manager. They've got some good players, and it's going quite well for them.
Potentially, to me, Chris, the most interesting game of the weekend, and one that I had actually, you know, I'm not here this weekend in the country, so I'm not going to get to see it, but it's one that I'd actually genuinely be very interested to see, and that's Birmingham against Liverpool. I mean, that one could go either way, and Birmingham have signed some very good players. In the end of transfer window, Beau Sejour, I think it will be a cracking signing for them.
Very good sign. I was fuming watching them get their deals done on deadline day, which is just pure jealousy. I hate saying it, but they've signed very, very well in this transfer window and built on what was already a very solid foundation, and I'm genuinely fearful that they will go past us this season. I think we'll have to drop significantly for that to happen, but I think we could legitimately finish 9th or 10th, and if we do that, there's a very good chance that they'll be better than us.
And what about Liverpool's chances against Birmingham?
On paper, you'd have to say that Liverpool just about have the edge, but I can't see them breaking Blues down enough to get the win.
They're very hard side to beat, Birmingham. They've got very sort of hard-working, combative midfielders, and they've got a good back four and a good keeper.
Now they've got Alexander Klepp as well there. I mean, that's real creativity into the side.
Yeah. And we were talking earlier about Scottish players who've come down. The guy they signed from Rangers who plays in midfield, I know they signed a few Scottish players. Can't remember.
Barry Ferguson
has done very, very well there.
Craig Gardner's in there playing out of his skin as well. He's really getting up quite high on the pitch. I mean, he's obviously...
Yeah.
Been rewarded for that by scoring a few goals already, but he's had a fantastic start to the season. He's playing like the player that we'd all hoped he would turn out to be at Villa.
Yeah. Mm. Bizarrely, when they were in the Championship, Birmingham and McLeish especially, I don't think sort of created very much confidence that he was going to be there for a very long time. Hats off to him. Since he's been in the Premiership, he's been absolutely terrific. He signed well and he's got the best out of the players who were there already, so... Yeah, they're looking pretty good.
Could be another Birmingham loving in the pod like it was last season. Party game, I think you probably have to say this weekend, is Newcastle against Blackpool, Tim. And, you know, that's quite an interesting one because you've got the two promoted sides. Newcastle obviously hoping to do quite well. Blackpool just hoping to stay up.
Yeah. Newcastle look, without that many changes in personnel, much better than the side that went down, don't they? And Andy Carroll looks better in the Premiership than he did in the Championship. It's odd. What I've seen of Newcastle so far... I'm fairly certain that they'll sort of brush Blackpool aside. One of the things that Holloway's done at Blackpool is he remained very loyal to a set of players, but a lot of them, they don't have that much quality. I admire him for trying it, and maybe it was the only thing he could do. But I think Newcastle will have too much for them at home. I think Blackpool will get the odd party result. They are a party side. So someone like Chelsea will go there and lose. Almost guarantee that will happen. And it'll be a great story, and there'll be a big party in Blackpool. But I think Newcastle are going to stay up this year and Blackpool aren't. And so that it's a sort of... For promoted sides, what happens when you get promoted into the Premiership, if you support any of those sides, you target particular games. And so if you're Chris Heaton, you look at the fixture list and you say, OK, you know, if we're going to ensure that we finish mid-table and we've got no chance of relegation, we're going to beat Blackpool at home. And so, and of course, Ian Holloway might feel the same way. But I think Newcastle will have too much for them, especially at home.
Well, talking about Chelsea, Chris, they've got West Ham. And West Ham are, you have to say, a team that we hesitate to throw around the word crisis because it's thrown around a lot in the media, but no points from their first three games at all. Grant probably, well, he might not be there for the game because it's Yom Kippur on that day, so he probably wouldn't be attending it. I mean, and Chelsea is not a team you want to come up against when you're in that kind of form, that kind of run. Well, Chelsea are in that kind of, I mean, goal difference of plus 14 already after three games of the season.
Yeah, there's only one way this game's going, isn't there? I think once West Ham had lost their second game, you looked at the next couple of fixtures and it was always going to be 4 out of 4. And I presume that Grant was targeting the games after that to try and mount a revival. So I think this game was probably written off weeks ago.
And then we look at the two other fixtures as well. Moneybags FC against Blackburn Rovers, Tim. It's kind of banana skin that Man City have in recent seasons had a habit of slipping over in a quite comic fashion.
Not this year, Gary. I watched Blackburn at home to Arsenal. I think what'll happen is, because I think Allardyce has done something positive at Blackburn. I think they're better now than when he got the job. But I think they'll compete for an hour and eventually succumb to sheer weight of talent and wage packet, which is flowing forward in attack after attack after attack. And that's basically what happened if you watch them at home against Arsenal last, whenever the last game was, 2 weeks ago. It's what happened. You know, they can compete for a certain while, but I think ultimately, you know, the players that Manchester City have got will end up beating them.
And the final game this weekend, Chris, final word goes to you on the Premier League.
Thanks.
Fulham against Wolverhampton Wanderers. Which, I mean, it's
decent.
On paper, very could be a potentially very entertaining game. I like Wolves this season, yeah. And I like what McCarthy's done.
They look like a Premier League team this season, don't they? Who are they going to go out and batter, though? I guess they have to pinpoint a player and try and break his legs, don't they? Like they did with Joey Barnes. I don't know who's that going to be.
And I mean, Fulham as well. I mean, it's kind of transition period for them under Hughes as well. But again, I mean, Tim was talking about targeting teams where you're going to take points off. This is one that they would be hoping for 3 points.
Yeah,
would be expecting 3 points against Wolves.
Yeah, at home they will be expecting 3 points against Wolves. But Wolves are more than capable of going there and getting a win as well this season, I think. Home advantage for me this one. I think Fulham are going to do okay this season, and that is going to mean beating teams like Wolves.
Okay, right. Well, I think that's just about it. We've covered an awful lot of ground on this pod. Next pod, Hörlitzville come in. We're having das Bundesliga special. I don't know what the word for special is in German. I'm sure they're going to mind Deutsch sehr schlecht.
I've got no idea what Gary just said.
Family show.
Yes, we're going German special next week. Terry's back in, and we'll be looking at all things German football. But in the meantime, Tim, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Feel free, give Pick Live a quick plug, as you're always allowed to.
Oh, yeah. Pick Live is an online football game. We have had a bit of a break because of the internationals, but we've got a very busy weekend coming up. We're covering all the Premiership games, so Everton, Man United on Saturday will be the next chance to play. We're doing La Liga from this weekend as well, so we've got Barcelona versus Hercules featuring David Trezeguet at 5 o'clock on Saturday. So no better way than spending your tea time than playing a bit of Pick Live. And then, yeah, during the week, we're back to Champions League action in the week with some very tasty fixtures, actually. I'm particularly looking forward to Man United Rangers. So all good.
As I'm sure many other people are. Chris, thank you as ever. Internet is coming back. Are you going to any games this weekend?
Yes, I'm going to Tooting versus Bolton Casuals in the FA Cup.
Wonderful stuff. I'm off to watch Steve McLaren's Wolfsburg this weekend, hence the German special next time. And as I say, Terry's in, we'll be chatting that. We'll be chatting Champions League as well, probably plus a bit of Premier League, a bit of MLS, all the usual gubbins. If you've got any questions for us, do get in touch. twitter.com/twofootedtackle if you want to talk to Chris during the week about football. facebook.com/twofootedtackle if you want to become a fan of the show. Please do leave us questions there as well. We love, we just genuinely do love people who get in touch. Leave it on there if you've just discovered the pod. We'd love to hear from you and why you like it and what you'd like improved. twofootedtackle.com if you haven't been to the site yet, do have a look. It looks fantastic. It's been redesigned. Loads of great new writers on there for, who you can come enjoy. We mentioned Seb Gevers from Inside Left, got Matt Roger on there. I'm on there, but you know, you probably don't want to read that stuff. You can email us as well, podcast@twofootedtackle.com. That's about it. Take care, enjoy your weekend, and we'll be back next week. twofootedtackle.com